The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Navigating Advances in Alzheimer's Disease, an expert consult on integrating the new diagnostic tools and disease-modifying therapies into your clinical practice. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/AMU860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Hello, my name is Dr. James Galvin. I'm a professor of neurology at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. I want to welcome you to our program, Navigating Advances in Alzheimer's Disease, an expert consult on integrating the new diagnostic tools and disease-modifying therapies into your clinical practice. Our goals for this activity to increase the use of biomarker testing to facilitate early and accurate diagnosis, to improve your understanding of the rationale for use, the mechanism of action, and the safety and efficacy profiles of approved and emerging disease-modifying therapies, to boost your ability to identify patients with MCI or mild dementia due to Alzheimer's disease who would benefit from these new therapies, and to equip you with the skills needed to integrate novel disease-modifying therapies safely and effectively into your clinical practice. So first, let's talk about how the biomarkers could be used. What's the application for them? Well, first, they can be diagnostics or screening. You want to select cases that truly have Alzheimer's disease for inclusion into clinical trials and to make a correct, accurate diagnosis for the initiation of treatment with the disease-modifying medicines. You want to be able to monitor the effects of drug candidates and other interventions. This includes identifying and targeting engagement of a drug candidate to identify any downstream effects on Alzheimer's disease pathophysiology, and then to predict or confirm the clinical benefits from the disease-modifying therapies. I'm going to be calling these DMTs throughout the program. Last, there's lots of research going on, and so we want to be able to use these biomarkers to study the Alzheimer pathophysiology directly in patients and identify genetic and environmental risk factors. Now, what's important about the biomarkers is we have staging processes called the ATN framework. A stands for amyloid beta proteinopathy, T stands for tau proteinopathy, and N stands for neurodegeneration. And when we classify patients by their biomarkers, we can determine who's in the Alzheimer continuum and who's not. So if they have no biomarkers, they're thought to be normal, at least in terms of the Alzheimer pathway. If they have amyloid present, then they belong in the Alzheimer continuum. And if they don't have amyloid present, but they have some other pathologic changes, this is a non-Alzheimer pathology. And we know from a number of models that there is sort of a progression of Alzheimer biomarkers across the spectrum. So first, we see changes in amyloid beta protein 42, both in the CSF and in plasma, and this is followed by changes in amyloid PET. This is subsequently followed by changes in phosphorylated tau, p-tau, in both the CSF and plasma. And then we see breakdown in neuronal markers and synaptic markers, including things like neurogranin, see things on tau PET. It takes a little while, but then we start to see those changes in MRI, other changes in neuronal injury, such as neurofilament light chain. And then ultimately, we see patients who have global changes in their cognition and activity of daily living. But by the time this happens, there's already a long cascade of pathologic changes that we can now pick up with the use of biomarkers. So this ATN proposed criteria has recently been expanded because we know that many patients have a mixed dementia. So not only do we have amyloid, tau, and neuronal injury, the newer additions are I for inflammation. And the way we can measure that is with GFAP, glial fibrillary astrocytic protein. We have a V marker, which is for vascular brain injury. And the only way we can really do this right now is on MRI. And then S stands for synuclein, which are the building blocks of Lewy bodies. And the only way we really have to do that is with a CSF study looking at a seeding assay. So if we characterize these different biomarkers, then we could start to determine what cases someone may have in front of us and whether they're an appropriate candidate for a DMT. Now, there are advantages, but there are also limitations to using these different biomarkers. For example, PET scan, we can measure amyloid and we can measure tau. And these things are associated with changes in the patient, and we can follow responses to therapy. They have a long history of use and standardized interpretation. There are multiple FDA-approved tracers, and it really does reflect both the distribution and the amount of pathology. But they're costly, particularly without coverage. They have limited capacity and availability, depending on where you're located in the country. They are mildly invasive because there is exposure to some radiation. And you can only measure one at a time. So you can only do an amyloid PET. And then at some point later, a person has to come back to do a tau PET. Now, spinal fluid, we could measure A-beta 42-40 ratios. We could measure total tau. We could measure phospho-tau. We can measure the ratios of tau to A-beta. These are widely available. They're reimbursed by Medicare for certain diagnoses, including Alzheimer's disease. They have a long history of use, again, standardized interpretation. They can be performed by a number of providers, a radiologist, a neurologist, or an advanced practice provider. There are some limitations. Of course, it is invasive. It's a lumbar puncture, and not all patients like that. There are some relative contraindications, depending on the person's underlying medical conditions as to whether they're a candidate for an LP. They can have post-LP complications. But also, it's really important, there are some test characteristics that may vary by the method. Spinal tap done, and the fluids are sent off to one lab. Those results might be different than the fluid sent off to a different lab. So there are sample to sample and measurement to measurement differences, and it's important to keep in mind. The plasma biomarkers, including A-beta 42-40 and the hyperphosphorylated taus 181, 217, and 231. Now, these are CLIA certified, so they can be used clinically. They're minimally invasive. They can be widely accessible. They can be ordered by any provider, and they're analytically validated. However, they're not reimbursed by CMS. The test performance does vary a little bit by assay and measurement and by lab. So if you send something to a Quest lab, that A-beta 42 measurement might be different than if you sent it to a specialty lab like C2N. So there are different companies that have different assays, and it's not exactly the same the way the measurements come back. And it's relatively new, so it does lack validation in the general population, and there are lacking appropriate use guidelines. So there are some limitations to all of these tests. So let's talk about PET imaging first. So as you can see on this slide, the first aspect is amyloid PET imaging. And what we can see is differences between people who are amyloid positive and amyloid negative. Amyloid negative individuals, there is some uptake of the tracer, and you generally see it in the white matter. So it sort of looks like a skeleton or a tree during the wintertime where there are no leaves. So you just see that framework. But in an amyloid positive study, you see that the amyloid tracer goes all the way out to the cortical surface. So it has a blush that goes all the way out. You think about it as a tree that now has all its leaves in place. There are a number of approved tracers. Most of the ones used clinically are F18 compounds. There is another compound, a C11 compound called PIB, that requires a cyclotron right on site and is largely just used for research. Now, what is the appropriate use for an amyloid PET? Well, it's appropriate to use it in a person with a persistent and progressive unexplained mild cognitive impairment if they satisfy core criteria for possible Alzheimer's disease, but have a somewhat unclear presentation, an atypical presentation, or possibly an etiologically mixed presentation. Patients with progressive dementia occurring atypically at an early age, and to confirm the presence of amyloid pathology prior to initiating anti-amyloid DMT. Amyloid imaging is inappropriate in several situations. So if a person has all the core criteria for probable AD with a typical onset, there's not necessarily a reason to do the amyloid PET. It's not appropriate to do this to determine dementia severity, as amyloid deposition is not related to symptom progression or severity. If it's based solely on a family history or the presence of an APOE4 allele, persons with a cognitive complaint that is unconfirmed on clinical examination, in lieu of genotyping for mutations in asymptomatic individuals and for non-medical uses. What about tau PET? Well, it's available. It's FDA approved. It has very limited utility in the clinic. It's mostly used in research. But what it can do is tell us about tau deposition. And most commonly, it's going to be abnormal in people who are also amyloid positive on a PET scan. The utility in a person who's amyloid negative for tau PET right now does not seem to be very strong. But it will better, one, establish the T part of the ATN framework, and two, tau is more correlated with disease stage and symptom severity. What about CSF? Well, the CSF biomarkers closely reflect the key pathogenic events and are highly clinically validated. So we can measure total tau in the CSF, we can measure A-beta 42, and we can measure phospho-tau, including p-tau 181, and more recently p-tau217, which may be a stronger association with the pathology. For total tau, we can see that the increase in tau, it goes up maybe 250% that we see in controls. This really tells you the intensity of neurodegeneration. For amyloid beta 42, it actually goes down, and it's reflecting brain amyloid deposition, so reduction to about half that we see in controls. And for the phospho-taus, they tend to go up, both 181 and 217, and they increase quite a bit, almost 200% of what we see in controls. Now, when we look at these core CSF biomarkers, so the A-beta 42, the total tau, and the phospho-tau, and we compare that to beta amyloid PET scans, what we see is there's good concordance. So the A-beta 42 corresponds very well with amyloid PET. The p-tau correlates very well with amyloid PET. Total tau by itself may not, but total tau as a ratio to A-beta 42 also shows good correlation. So you want to make sure you know what you're looking for and how to use it so you can best interpret these. And so in many ways, CSF biomarkers and amyloid PET can be used interchangeably for inclusion purposes or for diagnostic purposes. The ratio of p-tau-181 or total tau to A-beta 42 is often used in many FDA-approved assays. These ratios are very, very helpful. They're more helpful than the individual biomarkers. They show a much higher relationship to the probability of having Alzheimer's disease. So one way you can interpret these things, on this slide, we can see an example of a report. And so the individual units aren't as important as seeing the ratio of phospho-tau to A-beta 42. And that abnormal ratio suggests that this person would have Alzheimer's disease or not. So the Elecsys A-beta 42 CSF assays and the p-tau-181 assays, they're FDA-approved in vitro diagnostic. And again, combining the concentrations into a ratio is probably more powerful than looking at the individual assays. A-beta 42-40 ratio is also very useful. So the thing I'm really trying to get at is looking at A-beta 42 by itself is not as helpful as looking at its ratio, either related to phospho-tau or to A-beta 40. So A-beta 40 is not really the pathologic species, so the A-beta 42-40 ratio gives you a much higher likelihood ratio that someone has Alzheimer's disease. So when is it appropriate to use CSF biomarkers in the clinic? Well, one, if you have mild cognitive impairment that's persistent, progressing, or unexplained, if it's possible AD, a typical presentation, mixed etiology, probable AD, that's typical age of onset when the diagnostic confidence of the clinician is not high. If the onset of cognitive impairment is early, less than age 65, for a differential diagnosis, so Alzheimer's versus frontal temporal degeneration. Frontal temporal degeneration does not have changes in amyloid, and so that ratio would not be reflective in FTD. In patients with subjective cognitive impairments who are at increased risk for AD, and to confirm the presence of amyloid pathology prior to initiating anti-amyloid DMT. So very similar to the appropriate uses for amyloid PET. Now let's shift to blood-based biomarkers. This is really exciting because I think this is going to be the wave of the future. There's great potential for using blood-based biomarkers. They may become very useful as a screening tool, the first assessment a patient can get if they have cognitive symptoms. They may also provide guidance for clinical management. And because they're cheaper and more readily accessible, it'll lower the cost of doing a further workup. They've proven value in identifying patients with the disease and for monitoring drug effects. So if we look at a ratio of patients presenting with cognitive impairment and you do the blood biomarkers, we can see if you get a low probability back, that person probably does not have Alzheimer's disease. If you get a high probability, that person probably has Alzheimer's disease. And of course, there's a percentage of people who have sort of that gray zone intermediate. Then you probably would go on to do the more expensive invasive biomarkers, a CSF study or an amyloid PET. So which biomarkers are showing promise? There are a number of them out there. They're very exciting. So A-beta 42-40 in plasma is good. It's a little challenging because it's a little hard to measure, and the ranges in blood are much more restricted compared to the ranges that we see in CSF. What's really exciting are the phospho-taus. So the phospho-tau measurements, 181, 217, and 231, give you three different locations of the hypophosphorylation, but they have been shown to have a high accuracy to detect Alzheimer's disease. They're validated against pathology, against amyloid PET scans, and against clinical diagnosis. So right now, in the blood, the phosphorylated tau assays are probably the best assays that we could get. So what's commercially available? Well, an example of one would be Precivity AD. It's collected in a K2 EDTA tube, so a sort of a standard blood tube. There is some processing that needs to be done. It has to be centrifuged and pull off the plasma. And what this test does, it could measure A-beta 42, A-beta 40, the APOE isoform. So the proteotype is just like the genotype and puts together a ratio of A-beta 42 to 40 plus the APOE proteotype plus the patient's age into a clinically validated machine learning algorithm, and you get an amyloid probability score that puts people at low, intermediate, and high probability of having Alzheimer's disease. The high probability is highly correlated with amyloid PET scans. So this received breakthrough designation in 2019. It's commercially available since 2020 in most states, but not all states, and it's a CLIA certified test. More recently, though, it's been updated because all the information we have about phospho-tau. So to get a better picture of what's going on in the Alzheimer's disease brain, we can combine A-beta 42 to 40, which tells us about the amyloid pathology, with a p-tau 217 to a non-phosphorylated p-tau 217. So the percentage of the tau molecule at 217 that's phosphorylated. So this ratio of A-beta 42 to 40 to the percent p-tau 217 ratio probably gives us the best answer right now. It gives us a single sort of cutoff so that people who are older, who have signs of impairment, who have the Precivity AD2 test positive, have an 88% sensitivity and an 89% specificity. That gives us an area under the curve of 94%. So very good from a blood test to be able to say that this person actually will have an abnormal PET scan. Another test that's approved is an ATN profile, which you get back is the A-beta 42-40 ratio. You also get back the p-tau 181, and you get a measurement of neurodegeneration or neuronal injury in the neurofilament light chain. So A-beta 42-40 and p-tau 181 talks about the pathologic changes associated with Alzheimer's disease, while NFL talks about neurodegeneration. There's also the AD Detect test, and this is also a CLIA certified assay, and it measures A-beta 42 and 40 and gives a ratio. If this ratio is low, then this suggests having a risk of having Alzheimer's disease. So just like A-beta 42 goes down in the CSF, it also goes down in the blood. So the lower the ratio, the more likely it is to have Alzheimer's disease. It has good area under the curve of 86%. There's also the Simoa p-tau 181 test and the Alexis amyloid plasma panel test. So these tests are available and we can get a sense of whether the blood can tell us a lot about what's happening in the Alzheimer's brain. So because of these plasma biomarkers just emerging, a task force came together to talk about what's the appropriate and inappropriate uses for this. So the appropriate use, which blood biomarkers? Well, p-tau and A-beta 42-40 alone or in combination appear to be able to tell you what's going on, particularly in people with a typical amnestic presentation. NFL will help you look at the neurodegenerative process and when to use them in individuals with objective cognitive impairment, so possible or probable AD or MCI due to dementia, such as AD, if you have a suspicion of AD as part of the initial diagnostic workup, and of course, if there's any contraindication or the person doesn't want to do LP, where would you use them? Well, in primary care, it can help PCPs refer patients to specialists. In primary and specialty care, it could aid in the diagnosis and in clinical trials, so in the research setting. And how do we interpret these? Well, it's largely a holistic approach. We use models combining the different blood-based biomarkers and our cognitive performance to say, does this person, one, have an impairment, and two, is this impairment most likely due to Alzheimer's disease or due to some other process? Now, there may be a need to do CSF biomarkers or PET if the clinical presentation or other factors conflict with the blood-based biomarker results. Now, what's the inappropriate use is you know, replacing the things that need to be done, like cognitive testing. And if there's not a expertise in being able to, one, run the assay, and two, interpret the assay. So it's really important we have to balance out the appropriate and inappropriate uses. So let's move on now and talk about some of the novel and emerging disease-modifying therapies for the management of AD. So in June of 2021, aducanumab was the first medication that received approval. It got something called the accelerated approval for the treatment of early AD. In January 2023, lecanemab received FDA accelerated approval, and this was followed by full approval in July of 2023. Now, most recently, in January of 2024, the manufacturer announced the discontinuation of aducanumab. So at the moment, only lecanemab is available for clinical use. Sometime during the second quarter of 2024, we should expect an FDA decision on donanemab, which is another disease-modifying monoclonal antibody. So what do these DMTs do? Well, first, they impact AD pathophysiology. They can lower the amyloid plaques substantially, and they can make many patients amyloid negative within 12 to 18 months of therapy. There are consistent signals on the impact of these monoclonal antibodies on other AD biomarkers, such as tau, inflammation, and neurodegeneration. The other thing is that they actually have evidence of slowing clinical decline. It's consistent group-level efficacy, so showing decline for the average patient when the amyloid plaques are sufficiently lowered in the right patients. So in early stage AD, that's mild cognitive impairment due to AD and mild AD. Okay, so that's the appropriate patient population for these medications. And the treatments provide, on average, the equivalent savings of 5 to 7 months of expected decline compared to a placebo. So this is really going to change the paradigm, the way we approach Alzheimer's diagnosis and care. Now, there are some limitations and safety concerns and some burden on the patients. They are infusions. They are costly. There's currently limited access. So are the healthcare providers ready? Are the systems ready? They have to ramp up, and there are coverage considerations. CMS requires the patients to enter into a registry in order to be covered by CMS. It's not a good option or fit for all persons with AD. Remember, it's a selected population. Clinically, they have to be in the early stage. They require amyloid confirmation. An MRI is required, so the person has to be able to undergo MRI. And we need to demonstrate at baseline that there's no evidence of substantial blood in the brain or microbleeds. We have to think about genetic considerations, so people who are APOE4 carriers, particularly homozygous carriers, are at a much higher risk of having side effects. Serial MRI monitoring is going to be required. When we talk about the changes, the amyloid-related imaging abnormalities, or ARIA, these cannot be seen on CAT scans. So a person has to be able to have MRIs, and there are serial MRIs which are recommended and required if someone has symptoms. But with appropriate detection and management, ARIA is generally short-lived and generally not symptomatic. If it is symptomatic, it tends to be mild symptoms. But uncommonly, it could result in hospitalization and rarely in disability and death. So the providers and the systems have to be ready to deal with all these different problems. Now, each of the different monoclonal antibodies target a different area of the aggregation species. So amyloid, when it's released from a cell, it comes as a monomer. A monomer is sticky. It then makes a dimer, and then an oligomer, then a protofibril, a fibril, and then a plaque. So each of the different antibodies seem to attack different species of beta amyloid. Lecanemab works at the oligomer and protofibril side. Donanemab works largely at the plaque side. So each of them are going to be a little bit different, and those differences may give reasons why ARIA rates are different between the different antibodies. I just want to briefly talk about aducanumab, because remember, it was withdrawn in the end of January and is no longer available for prescriptions. But the original studies, the EMERGE and ENGAGE study on the PET results, there was a clear decrease in the amount of amyloid in the brain. So there was excellent target engagement. This was in both studies, the EMERGE and the ENGAGE study. There were some questions about the clinical benefits, which led to some of the controversies and eventually probably to the withdrawal. But it clearly had target engagement and removed amyloid from the brain. How about for lecanemab? So lecanemab has met all its primary and secondary clinical endpoints. So if you look at this graph, we can look at the differences between the placebo, which is in orange, and lecanemab. And for each of the primary outcomes, the CDR sum of boxes, which is a global clinical rating, the ADAS-COG, which is a cognitive test, the ADCS-MCI-ADL, which is looking at functional activities of daily living, and the ADCOMS, which is a composite measure. And what we see is in each of these, individuals treated with lecanemab had less cognitive decline than the people on placebo. So for the CDR sum of boxes, a 27% slowing. For the ADAS-COG, a 26% slowing. For the ADLs, a 37% slowing. And for the ADCOMS, a 24% slowing. Lecanemab also improved amyloid biomarkers. So here we're showing you for PET scan, CSF, and plasma. So in the CSF, it was cleared. So there was a greater than 59 centiloid difference between the placebo group and the treated group. In CSF, in a beta 42, remember lower amyloid is worse. So you actually see it looks like it's increasing, which is actually normalizing. And so we see a change for both CSF and plasma in the A beta 42-40 ratios. Lecanemab also has evidence of having downstream biomarker modification. So lecanemab improved both tau and neurodegeneration biomarkers. So in the top row, we can see its effect on p-tau181, both in CSF and in plasma. Now remember, in the case of tau, tau increases in CSF and plasma with disease. So now we're seeing a decrease of the p-tau181. In the lower row, we see neurodegeneration markers. So the GFAP gives us an inflammatory marker. Neurogranin gives us like a synaptic marker. And in both cases, you can see there's a reduction in those markers compared to what we see in the placebo group. Now, what's interesting, like all clinical trials, there's an open label extension. So this will allow us to look at longer term outcomes. So the clinical trial was for 18 months. The open label extension, we can now see 24-month data, and we can see that the CDR sum boxes continues to show improvements and less decline. Same thing for the ADAS-COG and the ADL. And if you look at the overall population, we see effects. And if you look at those people who had at baseline less than 60 centiloids of amyloid, you also see changes. So the milder the disease, the greater the effects that we see. When the disease is a little bit more advanced, the effects are there, but it's a little bit less. So it's really important, again, when we come down to the diagnosis part, is to make the diagnosis early and make the decisions early about whether this person's a candidate for a DMT. What's really interesting, remember lecanemab right now is an IV infusion, but they are testing a subcutaneous formulation. It may be a much more convenient alternative to infusion treatment because after being trained and observed for the first few injections, it could be self-administered at home. So in this particular study, they gave a lecanemab naive population and a conversion population from IV, and we studied the effects of the subcutaneous treatments. It had pharmacodynamic comparability, so it worked similarly to the IV form in terms of its pharmacodynamics, but it had a 14% greater amyloid removal. So that's impressive, and that also suggests that this could be a potential way of moving people off the IV forms into the subcutaneous forms. It appears to be safe, so similar to IV forms, there are injection site reactions that can occur. Skin rash can occur, and there's also an incidence of ARIA. The incidence of ARIA is approximately similar for subcutaneous as we see in the IV individuals. Now, local injection or infusion reaction sites, the timing and frequency and the severity of ARIA-E, both clinical and radiographic, were similar for subcutaneous and IV deliveries. There was a sub-study planned using tau PET. Individuals that have higher tau, they have more diffuse deposition of tau throughout their brain. This may have some impact on the efficacy of disease-modifying therapies targeting amyloid. In the tau PET substudy, lecanemab slowed tau pathology in the temporal lobe. The effects were observed both in early and late stages of disease. And so at 18 months, those individuals had low tau, 76% had no decline, and 60% improved on the CDR sum boxes. We saw similar types of effects for both the cognitive outcome, the ADAS-COG, and for the activity of daily living scale. So while we have options to treat patients, those patients who are the earliest, who have the least amount of tau pathology, are going to have the most robust responses. What's also interesting is during the phase two study, typically a study is stopped, and then eventually they decided to go into an open label extension, but there was a gap. So there was a period of time, approximately 18 months, where no one received any therapy, right? So that gap, we got to see sort of what happens to the patients while they're not being treated. And what happened was that their amyloid didn't really change. There's a little movement of the line, but essentially no real change. The A-beta 42-40 ratio did change a little bit, but overall, they were better than the placebo, or they started to show some decline. Okay, so this would suggest that while there's a gap period that could occur, patients may actually have to continue medicines at some point later, but it also supports this concept of disease modification because the patients, as they decline, they are paralleling the prior placebo group. So we've altered the disease now in some way by removing the amyloid and affecting those downstream measures, tau, inflammation, neurodegeneration, et cetera. What about donanemab? Remember, donanemab is not yet approved. It's under review. So donanemab met its primary and secondary clinical endpoints as well. So its primary endpoint was the IADRS, which again is sort of a composite. And so here we present the data in the low to medium tau group and in the combined tau population. So looking at all people in the trial. And you can see in the low to medium tau group, there's a 35% slowing in the primary outcome, the IADRS. For the total population, it was 22%. If you go to the JAMA paper and read it, and then the supplemental materials, you can see the high tau group is very similar to placebo. So again, the level of tau may affect the response to the medications. For the CDR sum of boxes, a secondary clinical outcome, there was a 36% slowing in the low-medium tau group and a 29% slowing in the overall population. There was also a significant reduction in the amyloid and tau biomarkers. When we look at the amyloid PET, and that's in the upper left-hand corner, you can see, you know, almost a complete removal of amyloid compared to the placebo by the end of the study at 76 weeks. If you look at just to the right of that on the top row, you can see that the participants with amyloid clearance, that is, they had less than 24.1 centiloids. By 76 weeks, nearly all of them had almost complete reduction or clearance of their amyloid, and you can't even see the placebo group on this bar graph. And if we look at the differences between the low-medium tau population, the combined population, there was a 39% decrease from baseline in the donanemab group in the low-medium tau and a 35% decrease in the baseline in the combined population. So it worked for the whole group, but particularly for those individuals in the low to medium tau population, you had a little bit of a more robust response. All right, so let's spend some time now talking about ARIA. So what exactly is it? Well, these are treatment-related changes that are noted on neuroimaging studies. There are two types, ARIA-E and ARIA-H. ARIA-E is the abnormalities because of vasogenic edema, and in ARIA-H, the abnormalities are due to microhemorrhages and superficial siderosis or hemosiderosis. Okay, so we have some examples on the lower part of the slide here. You can see four cases of ARIA-E, and it could be very subtle, just a little swelling in the sulcus to something that almost looks like a mass effect. So it's really important that, you know, the radiologists are also trained to recognize ARIA-related changes. ARIA-H will be microhemorrhages, and those would best be seen on a T2 star or GRE or an SWI weighted image, and they'll look like black dots, but in the parenchyma. And so, you know, we can see two examples here up in the higher convexity of the cortex, but also deep in the basal ganglia. ARIA is the most common side effect associated with anti-amyloid monoclonal antibodies. Typically, it's transient and asymptomatic and resolves on its own. However, serious and life-threatening events can rarely occur. So it's important to understand the risk factors for ARIA and to be able to detect ARIA early in order to prevent serious adverse events. The ARIA risk factors include the number of copies of APOE4 alleles. So those with no copies are at the lowest risk, people with two copies are at the highest risk, and people with one copy are at intermediate risk. The dose of the monoclonal antibody is a risk factor. The presence of underlying cerebral amyloid angiopathy is a strong risk factor, and the presence of cerebral vascular disease is a risk factor. This is why the baseline MRI is so important. If we look at the incidence by antibody, so we have aducanumab, donanemab, and lecanemab, you can see that the incidence of ARIA E or H, either one, is highest in aducanumab and lowest in lecanemab. For ARIA E, again, 35% in aducanumab, 27% in donanemab, 12% in lecanemab. ARIA H is 33% in aducanumab, 30% in donanemab, and 17% in lecanemab. Now, in the gray shaded boxes there, you can see the risk by carrier status of APOE. And you can see that for each antibody, the risk increases. So if we look at focusing on lecanemab for the moment, you can see while ARIA-E occurs in 5.4% of non-carriers, it's up to 32% in homozygous. For donanemab in the clinical trial, it was 11% for non-carriers and up to 44% in homozygotes. Similarly, for ARIA-H, there also is a stratification by APOE genotypes, lowest in people who are non-carriers, highest in people who are homozygous. What about some of the emerging therapies? Well, there's a vast, vast pharmacologic pipeline. There's an urgent need to develop many medicines, both symptomatic therapies as well as DMTs, and not all of them are targeting amyloid. There are over 140 different agents currently in development, and several new therapeutics are expected over the next several years. And these are going to target multiple areas. So there are anti-tau therapies targeting metabolism and bioenergetics, immunity, oxidative stress, mitochondrial dysfunction, inflammation, proteostasis, synaptic plasticity, the vasculature, growth factors, hormones, genetics, epigenetics, transmitter receptors. So there is just a wide, wide range of therapies out there. So it is going to be, I think, a lot like oncology, where patients aren't treated with a single agent. It's really going to be sort of a precision approach using biomarkers to help us identify what's the best targets for our patient, and there'll be some combination of therapies to treat the disease. All right, how do we begin to adapt our practice to handle all of this? Well, there are some really key stages in the diagnostic process. The first thing we have to do is we have to detect disease. We just can't dismiss mild memory complaints. And often this is seen out in the primary care setting. And so doing a simple, quick cognitive test may give you some information. And then we move on to the next step, which is beginning to assess and differentiate, right? Let's do a neurologic test. Let's do a more in-depth cognitive test. Let's get an MRI so that we can assess the brain, assess the patient, assess what's going on. And then we want to diagnose. And the access to AD biomarkers is really going to change the game. So whether it's the blood-based biomarkers, CSF, or PET scans, we're going to be able, in a living person, to determine whether they have amyloid or some of the other abnormal proteins. So now you establish a diagnosis, and then we can treat, okay? And the treatments at the state of the art is going to include anti-amyloid monoclonal antibodies. And you can see at the bottom that early detection clearly is in the world of the primary care. That next step for differentiation could be handled by both primary care and specialist, but likely most of the biomarkers and the treatment, at least in 2024, is going to be handled by specialists. So how do we select patients to treat? Remember, it's for people with the earliest Alzheimer's disease, so MCI due to Alzheimer's or mild Alzheimer's dementia. We have to confirm amyloid positivity at the present time, that's by PET or CSF. Blood biomarkers may come into the equation, but right now it's PET or CSF. And we expect that they'll have a mini mental score or some other comparable test that suggests they're at mild stages of disease. The exclusion criteria, that baseline MRI, if they have four microhemorrhages or more, if they have an area of superficial siderosis, if they have significant cerebral vascular change, if they have a macrohemorrhage or multiple infarcts, they're not a good candidate for drug treatment. If they can't have MRIs, they're not a candidate for treatment. If they're on anticoagulation because of the bleeding risk, they're not a candidate. If they have unstable medical or psychiatric conditions, that could be a relative contraindication. Kind of have to look at each patient on a one-to-one basis. Now, population-based studies have shown that most patients may not be eligible for treatment. So when we look at what's going on in the real world with real world patients, there are a whole bunch of reasons why people might not be candidates. They could have any form of cardiopulmonary disease, particularly if they're on any form of anticoagulation. They're excluded. A number of CNS-related conditions, they would be excluded. Based on their imaging, over a third of patients might be excluded. If they have a history of malignancy, that can also be a contraindication for treatment. Also, autoimmune disorders, and if they're on any immunosuppressive agents, that would be a contraindication. So, a step-by-step guidance might be, first, check for cognitive impairment, determine whether this is MCI due to AD or mild AD. Get your structural imaging. Get routine lab tests to rule out non-Alzheimer causes. Develop a differential diagnosis. Then you want to confirm the diagnosis with an antibody, with an A-beta pathology biomarker. You want to evaluate for any pre-existing ARIA if not already done. Recommend you do ApoE testing because this way you can have an informed discussion about side effect risk. And then initiate therapy with a disease-modifying medication. Then you're going to perform follow-up MRIs to monitor for ARIA. You want to also have some patient counseling information. Right. And so there are resources that you can develop within your own practice to discuss and inform patients about what ARIA is and about the risk. You want to be able to explain why you're measuring the APOE4 gene, because having one or two copies of it is a risk factor for having ARIA. You want to explain in most cases, ARIA is asymptomatic, but it can have serious consequences from headache, confusion, dizziness to weakness or a seizure. You want to instruct the patients to immediately inform the health provider if they're having any of these symptoms so they can have an MRI. Any use of any anticoagulant or a thrombolytic medication increases the risk of bleeding in the brain. And this is important because if they go to the emergency room at night and they have what looks like a focal symptom, in the emergency room, they're going to get a CAT scan. And if they don't see a bleed and they have a focal symptom, they might be considered for a thrombolytic therapy, and this could cause significant side effects. I think it's really important that you work with your hospital system so that everybody's aware of these risks. Hypersensitivity reactions occur generally in the first 1 to 3 infusions, and this is why there's a period of time that patients should be watched before they leave after getting their first couple of infusions. There are national registries out there. You have to enroll people in the CMS registry in order for the CMS to reimburse for the medications going to be required. Okay. There are some other registries that CMS has approved, and you can do those instead. CMS is probably the simplest of them to fill out. The next thing is obviously finding an infusion center, right? And so you can use this website, locator.infusioncenter.org, and they will identify infusion centers by you if your local hospital doesn't have one. And this way you can check with them and find out if they are equipped and ready to do anti-amyloid monoclonal infusions. What about the management of ARIA? Well, first we want to characterize it, right? And so this is where your radiologist is going to be really important, right? Because we want to determine whether it's ARIA-E or ARIA-H. If it's ARIA-H, is it the microhemorrhage or the superficial siderosis variety? And from a radiographic severity, is it mild, moderate, or severe? So the key numbers are 5, 5 to 10, and 10, right? If roughly, if it's less than 5, it's mild. If it's 5 to 10, it's moderate. If it's more than 10, it's severe. So if you kind of learn those kind of catch points, you can look at your own films and determine, but you really need the radiologist to know these things so we can do the severity. And then you want to determine whether a person's symptomatic or asymptomatic, because that's going to guide your stop and start rules. It's recommended that there's a regular MRI monitoring. So they get an MRI within 1 year prior to initiation, and then prior to the 5th, prior to the 7th, and prior to the 14th infusion. And if they have any symptoms, they will get MRI following up until the symptoms on the MRI resolve, not the clinical symptoms, but the MRI findings. So what do you look for clinically? Well, you're looking for an acute or subacute onset of a new neurological symptom. If the symptoms are mild, you want to note the discomfort and does it not interrupt with their everyday activities. If it's moderate, the symptoms are interfering with their everyday activities, and severe, they're incapacitating. This allows you to sort of develop an algorithm. Now, it's going to be hard to walk through the entire algorithm, but the key thing is there ARIA-E or ARIA-H? Is the ARIA-E or H mild, moderate, or severe on MRI? Is the patient symptomatic or asymptomatic? And using all of those factors, you can look at this grid and determine whether you need to stop the medicine and is it possible to restart the medicine or not. So it can be challenging. It's important that you take the time to review this and review this also with all of your colleagues who may be covering for you, you know, over the weekend or while you're on vacation, so they understand what are the signs and symptoms, how do we determine whether ARIA is present, what type of ARIA, what's the severity of the ARIA, and is the patient symptomatic or asymptomatic at the time that this is discovered. Basically, if they're radiographically mild ARIA and they're asymptomatic, you probably can continue dosing. If they're symptomatic, you're going to suspend dosing. If they have moderate to severe ARIA-E or moderate ARIA-H, you're going to suspend dosing until there's resolution of ARIA-E, it goes away, or stabilization of ARIA-H. That means there are no new microhemorrhages. If there's severe ARIA-H or a large brain hemorrhage, they're permanently discontinued. You always have to use your clinical judgment. Now, in terms of resuming, once ARIA symptoms are resolved and either radiographic ARIA-E changes resolve or ARIA-H stabilizes, you can consider restarting the anti-amyloid antibodies. The decision should be based on a discussion of the risks and benefit with the patients and with their care partners. Recurrent ARIA can occur. Patients and the caregivers need to know this. So all these decisions about whether to start, to resume, require consideration of the severity of the radiographic changes, the presence and severity of any symptoms, the patient's APOE4 genotype, any comorbidities, and what other medications they're taking. Biggest concern is a person presenting to the emergency department with severe ARIA symptoms. Okay, they may look like they're having an acute stroke. Administration of a thrombolytic in the setting of ARIA has been associated with at least one death. And this is the autopsy from the paper. You can see their MRI. They had massive amounts of ARIA. But on a CAT scan, you might not be able to see that. It's below the resolution. So they got a thrombolytic and they had a massive brain hemorrhage and they died. And you can see their brain on cross-section here. For suspected severe ARIA, it's important to have a strategic plan and a team in place for triage, evaluation, and management, okay? You have to work with your emergency department. You have to work with your radiology department. If the person's having the symptom, you want to send them to the emergency department so they can be thoroughly assessed. They need a brain MRI without contrast. CAT scan's not going to do it, and that brain MRI has to have a flare, a T2 star GRE, SWI, or DWI sequence. The MRI has to be reviewed by a proficient reader who understands ARIA. If you see something that looks suspicious, if they have moderate or severe disease, or if they're symptomatic, you have to discuss discontinuation of the therapy, consult a neurologist, preferably a vascular neurologist with experience with these symptoms, may have to be admitted to the hospital for close monitoring, may have to transfer to a stroke unit or a neurologic intensive care unit if warranted. Okay. Protocols are warranted for the early initiation of treatment. So if they're having a lot of symptoms, maybe they're a candidate for a methylprednisolone. If they're having seizures, EEG is going to be required. Might have to treat with an anticonvulsant for seizure management or prophylaxis if it suggests that they're indicated. You may have to consider additional therapies if they're not responsive to methylprednisolone. And if you're on methylprednisolone, you have to have a plan for a transition to oral steroids. There's a lot of pieces that need to be thought about. All these things need to be sort of built into a protocol. And you want to be able to support the patient and the family with open lines of communication. Infusion reactions occurred in about a quarter of patients on lecanemab in the Clarity study. They're typically mild to moderate in severity. They usually occurred within the first two treatments, and they occurred up to several hours after the infusion. Most of the infusion reactions resolved after 24 hours, and they can be managed at home. They include things like fever, chills, headache, rash, abdominal discomfort, some elevated blood pressure. Severe reactions are rare, but a clinic that's infusing should be prepared with a bronchodilator, oxygen, and epinephrine. There are ways of grading the infusion reactions from grade 1, which is most of them mild and transient, all the way to grade 5, which would be death. For grade 1, you may not have to do anything. For grade 2, you might want to treat with diphenhydramine and acetaminophen in milder cases, or with oral dexamethasone in more significant cases. You might want to repeat the diphenhydramine and acetaminophen every 4 to 6 hours until the symptoms resolve. You might want to also think about prophylactic treatment. So following an infusion reaction, patients should probably be pre-treated with diphenhydramine and acetaminophen prior to the next infusion in order to prevent the effects. You could also think about using low-dose oral dexamethasone or methylprednisolone if diphenhydramine and acetaminophen are ineffective. Antihypertensive treatment could be needed if the elevated blood pressure. That doesn't happen very often, but it's possible. And you want to continue this prophylactic regimen until the patient remains asymptomatic in clinic and at home following 2 to 4 infusions. If they have an infusion reaction of grade 3 or higher, you have to permanently discontinue the treatment. A lot of resources that are needed by the clinician and the medical center to use an anti-amyloid monoclonal antibody. You need a physician who's skilled in the assessment of cognition to identify the right patient. You need MRI availability to do baseline assessments and to monitor for ARIA. You need radiologists, neurologists, and other clinicians who are expert in the identification and interpretation of ARIA and cerebrovascular lesions. You need to have the capacity to do either amyloid PET or lumbar puncture. You need radiologists, nuclear medicine specialists, neurologists, and other specialists who are skilled in the interpretation of amyloid imaging. You need resources to do ApoE genotyping. You need genetic expertise to counsel patients on the implications of ApoE genotyping. You need infusion settings that can be made available every 2 weeks for lecanemab and potentially every month for donanemab when the approval occurs. You need a knowledgeable staff at the infusion sites capable of recognizing and managing infusion reactions. You need communications channels established between the experts interpreting the MRIs and the clinicians treating the patients. You need communication channels established between the clinicians treating the patients and the patient and care partner. You have to have availability of hospital resources, including an ICU, expertise in the management of seizures and status epilepticus, and a protocol with standard operating procedures for the management of ARIA. A lot of things are going into this. So, what are some practical tips? If you're going to do this, you really need to develop a site-specific protocol that takes into account all of the local stakeholders. If you're using your hospital's infusion center, great, you probably have knowledge of it. If you're going to use an external infusion center, go visit it. You want to meet the staff and the medical director. You want to be sure that they can handle the problems if they arise and that you have an open line of communication with them so that you know. You want to develop local inclusion-exclusion criteria so you can review your patients and some type of consensus process to review the cases for infusion. You need to come up with a process that you can identify the right patient to get the infusion. You want to ensure radiology and nuclear medicine have the capacity for scans and the expertise in reading them. Meet with the emergency department so you can review the signs and symptoms of ARIA with them. What I think is useful, consider asking the patient to get a medical alert bracelet signifying they're on an anti-amyloid therapy. And this will at least alert people that they're on lecanemab or donanemab or some other monoclonal antibody. There's a lot that goes into treating patients. The world is changing in Alzheimer's treatment. There are many more treatments available now. There are many coming down the road. We have this tremendous amount of knowledge of antibodies against amyloid beta protein, what they do, what they don't do, what the side effects are. There's this world of biomarkers just exploding. And so we're going to have to figure out how to incorporate this into our clinical practice. And you put all these things together, we have to come up with a plan that makes sense for our patients and for their families, and for us as the providers, in order to provide the best care for our patients. Thank you so much for your attention. I hope you enjoy this program.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/AMU860. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Aizai Incorporated.